We're in the midst of a biodiversity crisis in Ireland. Across the country, we've seen catastrophic declines of birds, wild bees and native plants. Even once common species of our farmland and open countryside, like the kestrel and lapwing, are now in trouble. The intensification of farming and forestry since the 70s led to biodiversity losses. As directed by policy and payments, more and more land was brought into production, and less space was left for wildlife. Yet if we're to reverse or even halt these losses, it is across Irish farmland that change will happen. If it's to happen at all, farmers are the ones who can turn this crisis around, and some have made a start. My name is Mary Brophy, and across a spring and autumn, I spent time with some Donegal farmers who are farming with nature, as they create or conserve habitats on their farms, and doing what they can to protect wildlife and their living. This is Nature Farmers. It's late summer on Inch Island, and I'm back on Boyd Bryce's farm. Today, he's bringing me to see one of the most valuable but rapidly declining habitats on Irish farmland.
This is for your...
Right at the first reaches where the pond is.
Yes.
Those are Scotch pine planted, that wee plot there. This pond is hundreds of years old. It was originally part of a mull complex. While I can't claim any credit for having created it, because as I say, it's 200 or 300 years old, even older than me. The only credit we can claim is we never destroyed it, we never filled it in. In fact, we tried to maintain it. We took a lot of stuff out of it recently. It was getting to be that it was turned into a raised bog.
Yeah.
As opposed to a pond. So
right.
We're all around the outside edge of the pond, and as far as the digger could reach, we removed the mat, because it was a mat at that stage, a complete mat of vegetation. So there's usually dragonflies and damselflies to be seen at this time of year. I've been here when there's dozens, depending again on the weather and the amount of wind and one thing and another. I'm not an expert by any means on damselflies or dragonflies, but there's quite a few different types.
Don't ask me, what is it? Some kind of
blue fly.
Which can hop or fly.
Yeah, hopping on top of the water.
Yeah.
Well over half of our ponds and wetlands have been lost in the last 100 years to land drainage, industrial peat production and development. Most that remain are small and under pressure, but they provide such vital habitat for so many species, from birds and bats to dragonflies and frogs.
And the vegetation would be of interest to some people as well. We have bog bean here, which is supposed to cure all known diseases.
Where's the bog bean?
The bog bean is that plant over there, just beyond those ridges there.
Yeah.
That has a white flower at a certain time of the year, and you pull it up and you use the root system for your cure-all. You boil it and you use the water after you boil it, and it's the most horrendous taste, and it cures absolutely nothing. Because I've tried it for personal reasons.
You need curing, boy.
I need curing. I'm still mad. Well, sedges, the ones out there blowing in the wind, those are sedges, and these ones here to the right are rushes. But our claim to fame in this pond here is newts.
Yes.
It's possibly the only site on Inch that I am aware of that has newts. And certain times of year you come here, we can get you a newt if you want one, you know.
But not today.
Not today. They only come onto the water to breed, and then they leave and go back out to the surroundings again. Oh, there's a dragonfly. Quite a large one. It went that away. Believe me.
Look at him just heading into the conifers.
Yeah.
He's gone over here.
Yeah, he's here now. There he is.
He's gone across.
Quite a large dragonfly, yeah.
Yeah. Well, we might go down to the other pond and see.
The shoreline.
As well as the mill pond, Boyd has maintained and created ponds and wetlands across his land over a lifetime. As we near the Lough Swilly shoreline, there are old flax dams, a new pond, and a large duck pond dug out 40 years ago.
The pond you put in and the other one that you put in down there.
Yes, yes.
That kind of wet grassland, they've all but disappeared now, haven't they?
Well, every advisor and every official that you would meet like would tell you to get that improved, remove it or improve it or whatever. And it's a death of a thousand cuts. Anything an individual farmer does not necessarily make a wild lot of difference, but whenever you have everybody doing the same thing, you do end up with a result. And whether that result's a favourable result or otherwise, is entirely a matter of opinion. And this particular, we actually created this piece of wetland here, so we've gone in the opposite direction. Now we have to put a digger in occasionally to reduce some of the sedge and reeds that's on the place, because it's getting to the stage where there's very little open water.
Just as we're here at the edge, a whole group of damsel flies have come. There's one just here, right on the grass.
I see it, yeah. A blue bum and a blue body.
As we turned up here first, you know, to the untrained eye, just looks like brown water and the grass is coming out through. And then suddenly that life, that blue flitter just wandered past us here, and it completely changes everything.
The whole aspect of it.
But there must be 10 or 15 damselflies just literally within an arm's length of us here now.
Well, you can imagine in the size of the pond how big the population may be.
Yeah.
If you take on the whole, there's probably half an acre of pond here.
Yeah, and we're just right at the
edge. We're just in a very small part of it.
Yeah.
And life attracts life on these ponds and wetlands, much to Boyd's delight.
The best thing I saw, or the best count I had here this year, I was up in that field there in the height, and there was 24, I think it was, tufted duck. The wee black and white duck that you see along the causeway there. I've seen one or two on it before, but 20 odd I had never seen before. There's some type of shrimp on that pond. If you look onto it, onto the water, that is, at night, with a strong light, it's full of shrimp. And we occasionally have a kingfisher on here, especially in the autumn, early winter, there'll be a kingfisher on here. And I would imagine, I don't know, may imagine in, but I'd imagine it's shrimp that it must be feeding on. So the kingfisher certainly would be a highlight.
What would you like to attract back here? What have you not got yet?
On the farm or on the pond? On the farm.
We'll start with the pond and then we'll go out.
Well, I would like to see some wild geese coming on here in the winter time, and we're taking steps to try and encourage them. We're going to remove some of this these bushes here, in case that it'd be a deterrent. Occasionally they do come on, and it comes in a half a dozen of geese, but it'd be nice to see 20 or 30 or 50 on it. On the farm in general, I'm waiting on a woodpecker. Woodpeckers are moving up from the south, and I have wood that needs pegging. If you see any about, you can send them my way.
I'm going to bring you up on this. This track is going this way, but I want to just cut across here up onto this other little track. What track was it on the last day?
Summer days are leaning into autumn now on Sheskin Moor Nature Reserve, and myself and NPWS Ranger Emer McGee are making our way across the flower-rich macaire grassland. We're on a butterfly hunt, or more precisely, a butterfly nest hunt.
This isn't the way I found it the last time, but let me see if I get myself oriented. Yes, on this track.
Restoring habitats of all kinds on Irish farmland is key to trying to stem the loss of our most precious species. And places like Sheskin Moor offer a glimpse of what there is to gain.
Oh, actually, there's one here. Find one when you're looking for one. Yeah, this is lovely, actually, Mary. This is just perfect. all butterflies are in decline, which is a terrible broad sweeping statement to make. So butterflies and moths are invertebrates, they're all in trouble. So when you look around here, you're seeing a lot of colour, aren't you? And at the moment, the dominant colour is this sea of purple, which is devil's bit scabious. What's devil's bit scabious is often closely associated with is the marsh fritillary butterfly. So it's the only protected insect in Ireland. And the reason why it's protected is because in the European context, marsh fritillary butterflies are rare. Like, I mean, I love doing this. I kind of go, now, if I was a marsh fritillary, where would I lay my eggs? Because I look for them all the time. I do two surveys for National Biodiversity Data Centre. And, you know, you can walk through a lot of it and not find the web. And it's called a web because it looks like a web, doesn't it? It kind of looks like spider's web. So you see what we're looking at here. But what'll catch your eye is it looks like brown, dead devil's bit scabious leaves. So the marsh fritillary will only lay its eggs on this plant's leaves. This might be three webs. So they might have started off here as eggs. And then, a bit like when our families grow and we're looking for more space, they keep moving a little bit. So often where you see them, you'll kind of see the old dead web.
These are all the caterpillars of the marsh fritillary right now.
Yeah.
And there must be...
I know. 50? How many? 50, definitely, isn't there? Yeah.
But they're not even the size of your small fingernail.
The caterpillars will feed from now until around the end of October. And then they will break up a little bit and they will go right down into the ground where you won't see them. And they'll pupate throughout the winter and then emerge as adults again in May.
That's fantastic.
And, you know, when you think, when she is flying, this isn't in flower. All that's here when she's flying is the leaves.
The base.
Yeah.
The base.
But that's their only food plant.
Though legally protected, this lovely orange and black checkered butterfly is considered at high risk of extinction in Ireland, primarily because of a decline in suitable habitats. Even on Sheskin Moor Reserve, where the landscape is managed to suit their needs, numbers are falling.
They need a network of areas. Mm. So when you always think anything to do with nature, isn't it? It's not good if it's just a little island surrounded by landscape that there isn't suitable for them. This little web, all this 50 caterpillars, they're not going to survive unless there's a network of other webs, and not just even all here in Maharamoa. They need to be over there in Sonfield, and they need to be out there in Caracalla, and then even outside the gate. They need to be within the radius of where you find them.
How are the population doing?
My base year here would be 2012, and there, in a nutshell, in 2012 there was more webs, which implies more adults, in 2012 than there is now.
Okay.
Yeah, so it has their fate here. I'm pointing with my hand one direction. In one direction, where there were plenty of webs in 2012, I'm getting consistently no webs.
Wow.
Since. And then in another direction, where they're about the same as they were in 2012.
Okay.
But then I didn't know about these ones.
Right.
So it also depends how hard you look. But if you are looking for consistency, looking at the same places,
you are seeing
year
drops.
On year on year, I'm seeing drops.
You're seeing drops.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And it's the same countrywide, presumably.
Yeah. And to think that we own the ground here and we know they're here and we think we're managing for them here.
Yeah.
So,
but the wider environment,
we need to do more. Yeah. You know, we need to be. Yeah. I like to talk about keeping the message simple and using general knowledge and common sense, but then sometimes you have to actually drill into it to find out
what's wrong.
Can I find out what is wrong, or what's missing, or what could we do better or change or improve on.
The fascination of the creatures with which we share this landscape is their particularity, how they evolve and thrive within very specific conditions. Devil's bit scabious, the only food source for marsh fritillary, is a flower that grows in damp meadows, marshes, and open woodland. Yet how many damp meadows are now drained? And so specificity makes these creatures vulnerable as we bland out and generalise our landscapes.
You can't pass Devil's Bit Scabious without seeing hoverflies, flies, butterflies, moths, spiders.
Yeah.
There's always bumblebees. There's always insects feeding on Devil's Bit Scabious. It is so best in class for what it gives.
When you look at it, I mean, it's like a pincushion of purpley blue, and it's just all of those tiny little florets are all a meal in itself.
Yeah.
So it's a wonderful kind of plant.
And
as we stood here, a helicopter of a dragonfly just went past. There's quite a lot of diversity here on the landscape, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. And like we're on a flat sandy plain and we associate dragonflies, damselflies with damp places. Yeah. But of course, all through this, it's really undulating, which also adds to the diversity. And behind us, behind those little hummocks, there are what's called dune slacks. So wherever the dunes kind of rise into little low hills or hummocks, when they fall, that's usually a little damp hollow. So it can be maybe just damp and mossy, or it can be damp in the sense that when the groundwater rises in the winter months, they are little kind of temporary ponds, and then some of them will actually be on permanent ponds because they might be spring fed as well. And in those dune ponds, because they're fed by groundwater, and then some of them are fed by springs. So what they're not fed by is rivers. So we have no fish species in them, and therefore no natural predators for the young stages of the dragonfly's life.
In this pasture here, we've got production trees. We've got cooking apples, we've got cider making apples, we've got pears, plums, cherries, and then a big host of eaten apples.
I'm back on Carl Mooney's farm outside Killybegs.
Then we've also interplanted nut trees, mainly hazelnut and cob nuts.
And in this field where his animals and poultry graze, Carl has planted rows of trees.
But they're way up in the air. They're not affecting grass production whatsoever.
While farmers have spent generations removing trees from productive land, Carl has planted these in as part of a novel approach called agroforestry, which integrates trees with crops or livestock on the same land. Agroforestry is said to have benefits for both farming and biodiversity, and I'm curious to hear more.
You're saying these are in 2 years, 2.5 years now.
Again, some of them might have been two-year-old trees, the bare root trees that I planted. There's a mix of everything here, to be honest.
What's this guy?
This is a pear tree here. I had one of the pear trees flowered this year, but these are probably about three. Some of them are, these are 3 years old. So they'll start to put on a little bit of fruit next year, I imagine. And then another 2 or 3 years, they'll start to come into good production. I'm not looking to get into the fruit production business. These are doing a few things here. The first thing they're doing is my grasses are going to root. The better I grow them, the deeper they're rooted. But for argument's sake, we say even if we grow really good grasses, they're going to root like 2 foot deep. They're going to have access to minerals in that level. Now this pear tree, when it's fully mature, think of it, like a 16-foot tree, it's going to root way deeper, down into the subsoil where it can get access to minerals that none of the grasses can. And it will mine those, it'll work mainly with fungi and bacteria, but mainly fungi, to mine those minerals and bring them up, and they'll be in its leaves, and then in the autumn time the leaves will fall off, and I'm cycling minerals from much deeper in the soil, so it's going to have that ecological benefit for me. Now these are actually planted in a very particular pattern. It's called a keyline pattern, and they're not planted on contour, they're planted slightly off contour, and it's all about moving water through the landscape, but then all the lines are parallel to each other because it has to be functional as well. So they're all planted on 14 metre centres.
But how are the trees working? Explain that pasture system to me.
Well, it's still very practical in the sense that they're parallel lines, and I've set them at 14 metres, which gives me a 12 metre clearance up the alley, and that works for me. Like if I was, say I'm just a suckler farmer and I want to make silage in this field, well, if my rake for making silage is 12 foot, maybe I'd make my lanes 24 foot, so it's two passes up and down with the tractor, and you make it practical distances that works with whatever system you're doing.
Agroforestry seems to be a good fit then for Cahill's system of farming. He's focused on building topsoil and biodiversity above and below ground, Because for Carl, this is the key to a productive and importantly resilient farm and landscape, able to cope with whatever weather or the world can throw at it.
You know, it's going to attract birds to the farm. It's going to attract insects, predator birds, predator insects. It'll may attract problem ones too, but for every problem, it'll probably attract a predator. All our animals are moving within these lanes. So, it's, you know, in the summertime, it's going to give shade, give a bit of shelter in the wintertime. And then we've got the production out of it. So the fruit is more of an insurance policy for the farm. I need to be a really unlucky person, but say bird flu got into my farm and all my poultry enterprises were scrapped and COVID hit, so like I couldn't do any agri-tourism or anything. That's a real tough year for me. So that year I'm going to take my fruit and really value add to it, you know, maybe make jams, make whatever, I'll do whatever I do, and that'll get me by that year. My goal is to build 6 foot of topsoil here. I want to be able to dig a hole that I can get down into, and there'll be topsoil at my feet and topsoil at my head, and I'm convinced I'll be able to walk through here on the, you know, the 1st of January in a pair of shoes, because my topsoil will hold all the water that we can throw at it. At the minute, you know, it takes about 2 weeks, not even a week of good rain, and then the soil saturated should run off the top. But I've only got like 3 inches. If I get 6 foot, I believe we can retain, and then that water's locked safe in there, so when it does get dry, it'll slowly release it. Whatever size of a hole you think you got to dig, dig it twice as big, because you're just trying to loosen up the soil around there and give it the best chance possible. And so we'll then also we'll soak the tree in a sugarcane molasses, because we want to get sugar is good for bacteria, so you want to get that association going early. And I also use sea kelp because it's got loads of really good nutrients. And I'll also get some ground up volcanic rock dust, which is just high in loads of, and that's a powder. And I'll, before I put the tree in, I'll shake the powder around the outside of the hole, because I want to get the roots, I want to try and encourage the roots to grow out. So I put the powder just outside of the reach of the roots to try and encourage it, because it'll kind of know it's there and it'll really push for it. And then we plant our tree and we'll backfill it. We won't really stamp it in, you know, we want it to be, we want contact with the roots, but we don't want it compacted.
Yeah.
And after that, it's on its own. If it thrives, then it's a good tree, and that's the tree I'll go for. If it dies, well, it dies. Because maybe one of the things we do as modern farmers is we try to keep things alive that want to die, and we try to kill things that want to live. That's a very hard way of living. And when I turn that on its head, and I let the things live that want to live, and I let the things die that want to die, my life got a lot less stressful.
Farming with nature rather than against it is working for Cathal and his farm. The ecosystem is finding a balance here, and so too is the farmer.
But it obviously makes you very happy.
It is, yeah. It's, you know, the great thing I find, because I work with nature now, is what does nature do in the wintertime? Slows down, hibernates, goes dormant. And so the farm is very much designed like that. We only keep animals here who can overwinter themselves, and they generally only need to get some hay. So in the wintertime, we do a lot less. We slow down. We live in a very, today, we're just bombarded with information, 24/7, 365. And I was living that lifestyle. I used to get sick, you know, I get colds, I get flu, wouldn't feel good. I slow down now. But there's something else happening. It's very hard to quantify. I feel like I psychologically go through a reboot. And I feel mentally very resilient. And for me, I think mentally, it's very closer to how we've evolved as human beings. And, you know, mental health is a massive issue with our, it's nearly a pandemic levels in our society. And I truly believe maybe it's that really fast shift away from that very seasonal lifestyle could be a big factor in that. And I know for me personally, it's living this very seasonal lifestyle is very grounding and keeps me on the straight and narrow.
I'm just thinking of it from a pleasure point of view, and you've been talking a lot about not wanting stress, but in terms of the opposite of that, wanting pleasure, it's going to look pretty amazing when you have this line of pear in blossom and then a line of apple in blossom. It's a lovely thing in a field.
Oh yeah, for sure, but it's completely not affecting grass production whatsoever. It's all benefits, I see.
Next time on Nature Farmers.
I definitely see change in my thinking. I started thinking more about the environment, you know, more about trees and what they bring, and the clover. As I say, when you can hear them bees humming, you feel that you're doing something good for nature.
Nature Farmers was directed and presented by Mary Brophy. It is produced by Neil Boyle. It is an IWR media production for Highland Radio, funded by Commission Naman with a television licence fee.